This is a reading of Advice to the Serious Students. It is Chapter 2 from the book Words to the Wise by Manly P. Hall. What advice do you give to a person who desires to apply himself to a serious study of the ancient wisdom teachings? The desire for wisdom is in itself the most commendable of human emotions, but in too many cases, this desire comes to naught through ignorance and misunderstanding. We must not only earnestly and unselfishly desire truth, but we must create within our own natures an ethical environment suitable for the reception of spiritual knowledge. If a building is to stand, it must be raised upon an adequate foundation, and if human character is to withstand the shocks of circumstance, it must also be built upon a firm and true foundation. No man can know more than he himself is. That with which we understand is the measure of our understanding. Before it is possible for an individual to perceive clearly the mysteries of the inner life, he must develop the faculties for this perception. From the most ancient times, the priests of the mystery temples were the custodians of the disciplines of philosophy. These disciplines were revealed only to disciples who had proved themselves worthy of such instruction. There is much more to the study of philosophy than merely listening, reading, and accepting. The first step in the study of the ancient wisdom teachings is not the quest of knowledge, but the preparation of self to receive knowledge. This is where most truth seekers make their first mistake. With their eyes turned toward the heavens, they rush ecstatically toward, quote, illumination, unquote, only to stumble, like Thales, into the ditch of their own unpreparedness. We know thousands of people who want to be wise, but very few of these people seem capable of understanding that before wisdom must come the capacity for wisdom. Illumination is possible only in an organism that has fitted itself for illumination. Nor does one so fit himself by hoping, wishing, or listening. As an athlete must train himself in order to excel in bodily prowess, so the student of philosophy must put his thoughts, emotions, and actions under specialized discipline if he is to develop philosophical strength. Between the modern truth seeker and the goal to which he aspires are numerous pitfalls and dilemmas. False prophets lead astray the unwary. Conflicting doctrines perplexed the uninformed, and a host of doubts and uncertainties weaken the resolution. Hundreds of students afflicted with these numerous problems have asked me to straighten out for them the tangled course of learning. The usual complaints of the confused go something like this, quote, "How am I going to know if this teacher is telling the truth? How can I determine which sect to join? How can I be sure that this book is reliable?" Among a thousand claims, pretensions, boasts, and persuasions, how am I to perceive clearly and straight the certain way that leads to light? Unquote. It is very difficult to reason with people suffering from religious glamour. For example, you may spend hours explaining to such a person that a certain Swami's breathing exercises will lead to nervous derangements and mental unbalance rather than illumination, only to find him a few weeks later studying the same exercises from another Swami. It is impossible to save anyone from his own foolishness. If, by some miracle, you can pick him out of a present evil, he only falls into the next snare that is encountered. Most modern metaphysicians suffer from an incurable attack of falling sickness. They waste their time and their means on pseudo-prophets and false gods. They prefer insipid platitudes to hard work. Now, at first thoughts, it may seem that the real cause of trouble is the false prophet, but upon more mature reflection, it is evident that false prophets can thrive only upon the stupidity and gullibility of thoughtless mortals, weak in the faculty of common sense. This leads to the major conclusion. Quote, a person incapable of discriminating between a true and false doctrine is unfit for any form of esoteric instruction, unquote. This sweeping statement may offend a class of people who feel that their souls are much more highly evolved than their intelligence, but the truth remains that a man incapable of unmasking a fake Mahatma is scarcely in a position to unveil the mysteries of the cosmos. If a student were to ask how to protect himself against the insidious effect of corrupt doctrines, I should say, if you are thoroughly, devotedly, and unswervingly dedicated to the acceptance of the immutability of the law of karma, you are above the contaminating influence of 99% of fraudulent metaphysicians. If you believe in karma, you know that you can never avoid the results of action or enjoy unmerited advantages. The universe, gods, and men bow before the inevitable edict of karma. There are no vicarious atonements or exceptions in creation. Law is final, absolute, and immutable. The disciple who takes his stand upon this fact will never wander far from the truth, but he who departs even for an instant from this certainty plunges into a sea of troubles. The doctrine of karma is sufficiently simple and familiar that even the average layman is capable of appreciating its integrity. Nearly all students of metaphysics pretend to accept the statement of karma as we find it in the Bible. Quote, as ye sow, so shall ye reap, unquote. Yet in practice, there are literally hundreds of metaphysical movements which seek in one way or another to undermine the teaching of this law by doctrines of, quote, special dispensation, unquote. To compromise truth is to deny God, and philosophy has no place in it for any cult that seeks to compromise with the law of cause and effect. A pertinent example of what we mean by compromising the teaching of the law of karma will illustrate this general thought. A metaphysical teacher claiming to speak in the name of a great adept recently stated that the long periods of probation and preparation prior to esoteric instruction demanded in the old mystery schools were no longer necessary for students of the spiritual sciences. By a new dispensation, this adept would open the doors of the inner mysteries at the present time to all earnest souls. Thousands of sincere people, forgetful of the law of karma, have been intrigued by this program. Their faculties of discrimination are numbed by the name of the illustrious adept used to further the ideas of this, quote, teacher, unquote. An informed student can have only one attitude on this matter. No adept of the Great White Lodge could possibly promulgate a doctrine inconsistent with the law of karma, and no man, adept, or even God, can in any way modify the working of that law. Adepts do not make the laws of nature, they serve them. The probationary rules and rites of the old mysteries are as much an inevitable part of man's spiritual education as infancy and childhood are a part of his physical development. As well say that a human being can reach maturity without childhood and adolescence as that a human being can reach initiation without probationship and discipleship. If I were personally convinced, which I certainly am not, that the adept referred to had actually made the statements attributed to him, I would still not believe them. Rather, I would derive the authority for my attitude from the words of Gautama Buddha, who stated on one occasion, quote, I will not accept the doctrine because the learned have so stated it, nor will I accept it because the gods themselves have so spoken. I will accept it only because it is true. Unquote. Euclid, the Megarian, was once asked by Ptolemy, king of Egypt, if there was a short way to master geometry. The philosopher instantly replied, quote, Sire, there is no royal road to learning. Unquote. The words of Euclid apply perfectly to the mysteries of philosophy. There is no royal road to truth. There is no shortcut to God. There is no patent formula for the achievement of wisdom. All things grow and unfold. Truth and wisdom in man must likewise develop according to the laws of their own natures. True students of the great doctrines that bring about the emancipation of the human soul are not interested in, quote, royal roads, unquote. A man seeking wisdom seeks the most valuable thing in the world. He desires a treasure not easily to be gained, but in value above all other treasures of the earth. He knows that those who, quote, live the life shall know the doctrine, unquote. By periodic detachment and repositing of the thinking process, every human being, in order to be truly wise, must learn to play as well as work. It is very hard for serious-minded people to enjoy occupations of trivial importance, but the human brain is so constructed that it cannot stand constant strain for a protracted time. There must be either a letdown or a breakdown. The arts offer recreation to those whose minds are immersed in the sciences, and the sciences in turn are necessary to those whose lives are given to the arts. Each life must have its vocation and its avocation, and they should be sufficiently different that they bring completely different faculties into operation. An interesting book could profitably be written about the recreations of the great. I cannot too strongly recommend relaxation to metaphysical students. Nearly all of those whom I have contacted in many years of public work have forgotten that philosophy is not only the science of living, but also the joy of living. We should all remember that if we do not live well in this world and appreciate the beauties of our present sphere, we shall scarcely merit a better world or a happier sphere. At first, these seven essential qualities may seem somewhat contradictory, but it must be remembered that it is the duty of the intelligent student to blend and balance what would otherwise be extreme courses of action. The blending of these seven qualities is the fine art of philosophy. He who completely accomplishes this blending is master of himself. Self-mastery leads to those higher ends of understanding to which all disciplines aspire. The seven requisites of the inner life, termed character, have already been outlined. So, we shall now examine the seven requirements of the outer life, which we call attainments. It is often difficult for students to realize that the perfection of self is the real life work of each individual. The building of character, the unfolding of consciousness, the development of understanding, all these are processes which operate only under the direction of consecrated and enlightened will. Perfection is not a gift from the gods. Each person must work out his own salvation with diligence. It was during these morbid centuries that we now call the, quote, Dark Ages, unquote, that beauty and joy were excluded from the religious life. The doctrine that the material universe is a place of evil from which we should attempt a precipitous exit belongs to the same period of religious psychology. It is true, philosophically, that the material universe is impermanent and that it is wrong for the human soul to invest its hopes of glory in material things. The wise of every generation have recognized the impermanence and insufficiency of temporal achievement. Yet, this has not caused them to overlook the important lessons which physical life has to teach. The most imminent of man's spiritual duties is the mastery of the physical environment wherein he has been placed by the lords of karma. To evade the physical issues of life is to evade moral responsibility. The old teachings are very definite on this point. The ancient mystery schools permitted none to receive the esoteric tradition who had not perfected, to at least a reasonable degree, the conduct of the outer life. No reputable metaphysical system has ever encouraged individuals to pray, meditate, concentrate, visualize, or affirm themselves out of those duties and obligations which form the motivating principle in material existence. This does not mean that metaphysical exercises do not have a place in the spiritual plan of life, but they are never to be regarded as substitutes for right action and intelligent thinking. It is quite evident that the initiates of the ancient world would not have demanded a high standard of excellence and ability from their disciples had not this standard been necessary to the understanding and application of the wisdom teachings. It is therefore wise for every truth seeker to perfect himself in all useful lines of knowledge. We call the seven branches of essential knowledge attainments because they are accomplished out of the efforts and integrity of the individual. The purpose of all knowledge is the perfection of the soul, the soul being that part of man which transmutes experience into spiritual power. The experiences of the outer life feed the soul, even as the impulses of the inner life nourish and sustain the objective personality. Olympiodorus, in his Banquet, describes the feast of the soul, explaining that every man very often feeds the body well, but permits the soul to starve. When the soul is starved, it dies, or at least loses its power to influence the mind and heart. Now, the food men eat does not retain its individuality, but passes through certain chemical changes so that only a certain energy resident in it is finally assimilated into the human system. In the same way, knowledge which man acquires does not retain its individuality in every case, but passing through an assimilative process in the consciousness is transmuted into energy which nourishes and perpetuates the soul. Thus, when men study music, art, literature, philosophy, or even the crafts, it does not mean that the soul receives into itself a heterogeneous mass of ill-digested experiences, or that the soul merely becomes the image of the art or science that has been attained. A divine alchemy transmutes all experience and knowledge into a hermetic medicine, the fabled panacea of the alchemists, that medicine which alone can cure ignorance, the disease of the uninformed. It is not reasonable to expect each man to be master of all seven of the ancient sciences. In fact, at this stage of evolution, it is a life work to achieve a reasonable degree of efficiency in one or two branches. Life is short and art is long, but the law of reincarnation assures us that centuries of opportunity for accomplishment extend before us, and that each life, if intelligently lived, contributes its part to the greater perfection that lies ahead of us. Through the seven requisites of the inner life, character, we become capable of estimating deity as quality. Through the seven requisites of the outer life, attainments, we gain the capacity to appreciate divinity as wisdom and activity. Of course, at the present time in our educational system, the metaphysical implications in the arts and sciences are denied or ignored, but this in no way detracts from the fact that these spiritual values exist. The arts and sciences, like most of the theologies of men, have been reduced to elements of an economic program, their aesthetic factors sacrificed to the selfish institutions of man. Yet, behind each art and science is a universal law, and those who would discover the divine agent should not ignore the God who lives in his own work. The seven requisites which constitute the ancient outline of knowledge, the links of Homer's golden chain, are as follows. 1. Mathematics. Under this heading are included the several departments of arithmetic, algebra, geometry, trigonometry, etc. Mathematics was cultivated by the earliest of civilized peoples. An exact knowledge of it is evidenced by architectural remains dating back to prehistoric times. Arithmetic is the science of exactness and bears witness to the consistency and immutability of law. The philosophical geometry of the Egyptians was the basis of Pythagorean philosophy. Plato was learned in the wisdom of Pythagoras and derived from this earlier teacher his celebrated axiom, quote, God geometrizes, unquote. It is evident to the scientists that mathematics is not a man-made science, but a discovery by man of a science that exists in the universe. A human being may possess a conscious knowledge of mathematical principles, yet he shares this knowledge with the most minute creatures. The cell of the bee, the shell of the radiolarian, and the geometrical form of the snowflake all bear witness to the universal arithmetic, a cosmic geometry. Among mortals, mathematics is one of the driest of the sciences, but this is because an ignorant generation has divorced calculation from the drama of life. Most of the beauty that we see about us in nature is due to some aspect of cosmic arithmetic. We live in the midst of universal equations. Strangely enough, this study of mathematics is closely associated with the stimulation of intuition. Certainly, no person who has read the commentaries of Proclus on Euclid can fail to appreciate the sublimities of the numeral theory. Thousands of students seeking God in numerous metaphysical ways, by failing to master mathematics, have lost the opportunity of perceiving divinity manifesting itself through the glorious geometry of form. 2. Astronomy. In ancient times, what we term astronomy was embraced within the all-inclusive subject of astrology. No classical philosopher could have been interested in the arrangements of the sidereal bodies without desiring to understand the effects which these bodies produce upon man. Astrology is moral astronomy, and astronomy is astrology divorced from all practical purposes. What use is it to know the number of stars or to discover the elements of which they are composed, to measure their orbits and calculate the intensity of their light, if, in the end, we deny that any of these factors are in any way applicable to human existence? The first astronomers, from their high towers, established systems of time from the sidereal motions. From these have resulted calendars, most of which we originally devised for horoscopal purposes. Under the heading of astronomy are to be included the whole anatomy of the universe, the theories of history, the mysteries of climate and weather, the mutations of season, all of which bring us naturally to agriculture and husbandry. In other words, astronomy was the orderer of life, one of the most civilizing of the sciences. To the mystic, astronomy is the key to magnitude values. Astronomy enlarges the universe, revealing a world too large for smallness, too glorious for meanness, too beautiful for hate, too honest for deceit. Astronomy reveals man's place in the plan. It shows him to be part of an infinity of incalculable life and reveals the whole sidereal diffusion bound together by an all-ensouling wholeness. Man's kinship with the stars and the grain of sand is established. 3. Biology and physics. These branches of learning gradually emerged from the alchemical researches of the ancient Chinese, Brahmins, and Egyptians. The first practical laboratory was that part of the temple set aside for research in chemistry and medicine. The various branches of research in the chemical factors of life were not originally divided into numerous departments as now. Priests were the first scientists and the first physicians and the first students of anatomy and physiology. We have listed these several sciences under one heading because they all directly or indirectly relate to structure and function. From these sciences, certain laws of nature become immediately evident. Man's exploration of nature and its processes gave rise to the theory of what we now call science. In olden times, these researches were not carried on by scoffing materialists, but by enlightened philosophers who discovered, beneath the superficial aspects of form, divine chemical and mechanical processes. Science is therefore the study of the anatomy of the body of God. The laboratory reveals not only the infinite mystery of life, but also the infinite complexity of function. Man's veneration for the universal wisdom that supports this supreme order, sustaining all things in their proper relationships to all other things, grew with the increase of knowledge. Knowledge brings with it appreciation, and appreciation is one of the most beautiful forms of religion. Man is never far from a truth which he has learned to appreciate. 4. Social and political science. This department of learning arose from man's contemplation of the motions and courses which are apparent in those social aggregates which we call nations and races. Included under the heading of social science was the vast body of tradition and research which has given rise to the laws governing relationships of individuals. The social sciences gave rise to the doctrines of morality and the various codes of convenience and compromise necessary to the survival of individuals under a social order. Therefore, we may consider with Cicero that civilization arises from the speculations of ancient wise men directed toward the improvement of community existence. Under the political sciences must be included government, leadership, and all regulation of community affairs by which the general motion and trend of empire is preserved toward those consistent ends for which empire was devised. Political science in the Western world had its origin with Solon, and received the refining influence of Plato and Aristotle. Statesmanship and political organization reached their heights under the Romans, with whom they also deteriorated into tyranny. Most modern governments are revivals of ancient policies, and the failure of the theory of governments in the modern world is largely due to the increasing interval between natural law and political purpose. The statesmen of old were philosophers, deriving their inspirations for government from astronomy, mathematics, and physics. When political science divorced religion and philosophy, it lost the name of action. Governments since that time have never survived their own inherent weaknesses. To the mystic, the study of social and political science reveals both the strength and weakness of existing institutions and prevents the earnest thinker from falling under the influence of traditional evils that have remained uncorrected since the decay of the religio-political institutions of antiquity. 5. Music and Arts. Under this heading are included the numerous aesthetic and cultural impulses which exist eternally in nature and have given rise to artistic institutions among men. Included with music and arts are, of course, poetry, drama, and dance. The aesthetic arts were all of religious origin, and their developments paralleling the unfolding of beauty in the human soul. To perfect oneself in an art is to feel a small part of that creative impulse by which the whole universe was brought out of chaos. Beauty has always adorned truth. First, because truth, moving through nature, is eternally producing beautiful effects. Second, because men, propitiating the universal good, were inspired to perform their rites and rituals through beautiful institutions symbolic of a divine beneficence. With the decline of classical civilization, man turned gradually from a religion of beauty to creeds of severity and melancholy. Several great nations completely destroyed their aesthetic impulses by the experience of Puritanism, which established vicious precedents that have impoverished national culture. In England, for example, Puritanism practically destroyed music. The purity of religious arts has been perverted among nearly all modern peoples. From the aesthetic arts, men learn to live beautifully, and when these arts are explored to their divine origin, they inspire the human mind to nobler standards of action and relationship, bringing dignity and purpose to all the finest of human relationships. The arts feed the soul, and soul starvation is responsible for much of the degeneracy and decadence which have perverted the aesthetic of the present generation. The loss of art results in the loss of soul, and the loss of soul, in the end, brings about the fall of the empire. 6. Language. Under the heading of language are included grammar and rhetoric, literature, and the whole theory of communication of ideas. The most ancient languages of the earth were mere sounds derived from nature by man, seeking to express such primitive emotions as hope, despair, love, hate, and fear. The history of language is a record of that gradual objectification of the subjective impulses of the human mind. Oral language gave rise gradually to hieroglyphics and written characters. Alphabets are conventionalized pictures devised by the progenitors of present races. Language is the science of expression. He who expresses well shares himself with others. With our eyes, we may all perceive together some outer phenomenon of nature, but with our ears we may listen to the thoughts of other men. We can hear their hopes, their dreams, and their aspirations, and we can share with them the fruits of our own experiences. The significance of language depends largely upon the meanings of words. Many of the greatest evils that have afflicted men have arisen from the misinterpretation of terms. This is particularly true in religion, where numerous conflicting creeds have risen up to interpret in various ways the simple words of a single sentence. It is the purpose of words to communicate knowledge, thus increasing man's common share of truth and enriching the life of each by the experience of others. Beautiful language has a ministry to perform, and those who desire to serve truth and become part of the philosopher's hierarchy should equip themselves with the power of right expression. To study language is to find the universe in sounds and the laws of life in the combinations of small symbolic figures called letters. The whole unity and diversity of existence is revealed in the mystery of alphabets. The evolution of language is as glorious a pageantry as the evolution of life. 7. Philosophy. The seventh place we have allotted to philosophy itself. Under this general heading, we include all man's groping for knowledge by the laws of mind. The word philosophy was first used by Pythagoras to designate the science of the love of wisdom. Man, living in the midst of an infinite existence, reaches out from himself by intellectual extensions and seeks to grasp the whole of infinity within the narrow confines of his own intellect, hence philosophy. The mind, being incapable of receiving and interpreting the infinities of the knowable, man of wisdom realized the necessity of exercising and developing the intellect itself, so that its capacity to know and to retain knowledge might be increased. Philosophy is more than merely thinking and arguing. It is the science of building up the capacity to know. Most people do not realize the limitations of their own thinking equipment. They do not appreciate the years of preparation which must precede the capacity to understand. This preparation the old masters called discipline. By discipline, they developed the numerous faculties of the thinking equipment until at last they gained the power to think God. By accomplishing this, they liberated themselves forever from the superstitions of those who could not think God. Superstition brings truth down to the level of ignorance, clothing it in innumerable falsehoods. Philosophy elevates man to the level of truth, creating within him the capacity to sense and to realize, to visualize and to comprehend. For this reason, philosophers are called the noblest race of men, for they alone perceive correctly the adequate reasons for the virtues of the race. To think is to wonder. To wonder is to discover. To discover is to know. And to know is to be a philosopher. This has been a reading of Advice to the Syrian Student by Manly P. Hall.